You're listening to Arrivé by The Cycling Podcast. This episode is made possible by Bicycle, the leading global marketplace for pre-owned bikes.
Hello, young Richard Abraham.
Hello, Daniel Freiber. How are you?
Very good. Where are you? You're not in Flanders, are you?
I'm not in Flanders. No, I'm in. Well, it's doing a good impression of Flanders, grey England at the moment.
Even, I can reassure you, Richard, even Mallorca, where I am, is grey today, grey and windy. But anyway, it doesn't matter because we're going to vicariously take the listeners to Udenada, aren't we? This is Arrivé, and we are today going to be focusing our attention on the men's Tour of Flanders, which has just finished in Udenada. A mere minutes ago, Richard, now usually we leave it half an hour or so. We usually sort of leave the race to kind of marinate a little bit and to, we take a bit of time to digest what we've just seen. And today, nothing to do with anything else that's happening in the sporting world today. But we are very much on the whistle, aren't we? And if we sound rather hurried, again,
there's 32. I mean, hypothetically, if we were to have an important engagement, or one of us were to, it would be in 32 minutes' time. But let's not. You know, we don't need to dwell on
no,
that, do we?
No. Very, very much hypothetical, as you said, Richard. Richard, I suppose what we ought to do first, and what we traditionally do in these episodes, on these occasions, is we sum up a bit of what happened today in the sort of usual ad hoc fashion, maybe more ad hoc than usual in Arrivé, making allowances for, our own proneness to errors when it comes to summarising races. However, I'm going to try to tell you a bit of what happened in this 108th edition of the Men's Tour of Flanders today, which began in Antwerp. It was 270.8 kilometres long, it was to be. And it was to end in Udenada. Now, Richard, there was some significant team news. There was some news even from, well, the team presentation. I suppose we knew this overnight. We'd known for a couple of days what the lineups were going to be. But it was significant. Of course, we had the dreadful crashes in Dwarsdorp, Vlaanderen in midweek that we thought, well, we were pretty certain, were going to deprive us and the race of some pretty big names. Visma Lisebijk, sure enough, started with without Wout van Aert, Jan Tratnik and Christophe Laporte. Van Aert, of course, banged up after that crash. Laporte still suffering the after effects of a virus, which has kind of blighted him the last few weeks. They did start with Dylan van Baarle, and they did start, or they did roll up to the sign-on in varsity jackets of the type you might see in, I don't know, a movie like Teen Wolf. What do you think of those, Richard?
Highly collectible items in, how long do we give it? I do actually have here a 1999 Mappe jacket. I'll show it to you, Daniel.
Oh, wow.
Not quite the varsity version. The sort of thick, sportful, winter, I think do I've, not wear or anything
yeah,
flammable
I think I've got one of
version. Yeah. So obviously that's 25 years on now. I think it's 99. So maybe in 25 years, is it a future classic, those baseball yeah. jackets? But maybe not for the current high street.
No.
Friday night, Sunday, Easter Sunday night.
Little Trek were not wearing varsity jackets. However, they rolled up the presentation ramp in Antwerp, minus Jasper Stuyven and Alex Kirsch, those two as well, victims of the same crash in Dwarsdorp, Vlaanderen, 3 days ago, 4 days ago. However, Mads Pedersen, one of the pre-race favourites, was starting the race, did start the race. No varsity jacket for him. And I think he said into an interview this morning, the 4 kilos, which he not inexplicably, there was a medical reason that he'd put on after his crash in Dwarsdorp, Vlaanderen, had also disappeared, been shed. I think he'd been in sauna work to try and get rid of those 4 kilos. He talked about fluid that had accumulated as a result of his various injuries in Dwarsdorp, Vlaanderen.
Yeah, I heard that too. I mean, probably does take its toll, doesn't it, after 6 hours climbing maybe not so important in a race like Roubaix, but you think for Flanders, especially a rider like Pedersen, where he probably needs every kilo he can get on someone like Jorgensen, a better climber at least, then yeah. But I mean that does happen, doesn't it? That's, I think, of crashes I've been involved with, it's the automatic body reaction, isn't it? And that's, well, but we'll move on to this. Pedersen looked quite strong, but I think it would be fair to say he probably wasn't at 100%.
We'll discuss that. The weather in Antwerp was fairly overcast, cloudy, but not angry.
Oh, sunny. Was it sunny at the start, wasn't it? It was quite nice.
Sun with clouds. Cloudy, but not angry. Wind speed 13 kilometres per hour. Southerly from the south. Wasn't likely, or didn't look as though it was going to have a big effect on proceedings. Richard, a group formed, eight-man group, pretty soon after the race had started. Luke Durbridge, Bert van Leerberger, Stanislav Anielkowski of Cofidis, Aymar Reinders, Damien Touzet, David Decker and Lionel Terminio. That group would stay away for quite a long time. Their advantage grew to just over 4 minutes. It touched 4 minutes, was over 4 minutes at various points in the first few hours of the race. After 70 kilometres, they also got delayed by a train. They had to stop to let a train pass. Richard, was it a
quote from Musée in Roubaix where he got held up by a train and then said in Belgium they would stop the train?
That might be right. I saw some hand-wringing on Twitter about what were people doing taking trains on the day of the Tour of Flanders. Richard, there were also some crashes in the early stages of the race. One significant one I did note down, 134 kilometres ago, Matej Mohoric and Dylan Turns were involved in a crash. Just sort of bookmark that for later. And as we got towards the sort of, well, the more intense stages, phases of the race, Albertsen de Koenig fired Axel Laurens down the road. And this was a very short-lived attack, but it did sort of signal how they were going to approach the next 30 or 40 kilometres. 100 kilometres to go, the peloton tapered towards the bottom of the Molenberg. Jumbo-Visma were pulling into the bottom of the Molenberg. Mads Pedersen attacked on the Molenberg. Matteo Jorgensen was on his wheel with Van der Poel just behind. Stefan Kung as well was in close attendance. Niels Pollitt and a group formed, was the first sort of select elite group of the race after the Molenberg. And then suddenly, Richard, there was a sort of strange phase where somehow a pretty dangerous looking group without Van der Poel formed. It had Narsen in it, Dylan van Baarle, Thijs Benoot, and some of the remnants of the early breakaway as well. Durbridge was there, Niels Pollitt. And Richard, because Van der Poel wasn't in that group, Albertsen started working behind. Van der Poel bridged across on the Valkenburg with 87 kilometres to go. And no sooner had he bridged across than Mads Pedersen attacked. And he got away with one of Van der Poel's teammates, Jannie Vermeers. To a lot of people's surprise, Jannie Vermeers then proceeded to start working with Mads Pedersen, and they would stay together for quite some time. Indeed, until the race got to the Oude Quaremont for the first time. Now, this was where Van der Poel put in a first sort of relatively tentative compared to what we were about to see, attack. Oyer Lascano was the next best rider on the Oude Quaremont the first time round. Laurens Pithy was also pretty close. Dylan Kuytens not far behind, and Tim Wellens as well. Matteo Jorgensen was not in touch with the leaders over the Oude Quaremont first time round. Then, however, the race came back together somewhat in time for the Paterberg. Ben Turner was the first over the top of the Paterberg, the first of two times around. And next, Richard, it was the Koppenberg. Now, the Koppenberg, which is always, well, visually, it's always impressive, stunning, shocking. However, it doesn't always, well, it doesn't often decide the race in the same way that it did today. It decided the race today in the sense that Matthew van der Poel got away on his own. Matteo Jorgensen was sort of 6-7 seconds behind him over the top of the Koppenberg, and it looked as though they might come back together. However, they did not, because Van der Poel accelerated and Jorgensen would not see Mathieu Van der Poel again. There was chaos behind Ivan Garcia Cortina of Movistar. Was one of, well, he had actually come onto the Koppenberg first. He'd got a bit of a head start on the Koppenberg, but he had to get off his bike. He dismounted. He wasn't the only only rider to dismount, and there was chaos behind. But Van der Poel, meanwhile, was romping away. And as I said, Jorgensen wouldn't see him again. And Richard, at this point, we can almost jump ahead right to the end of the race. The sort of final lap of the Quaremont-Paterberg circuit. Turns got away with Alberto Bettiol, and they worked pretty harmoniously together for a long time. It looked as though they were going to get second and third, but they were caught as they came into Oudenaarde, long after Mathieu van der Poel had won the race for the third time.
There were echoes of E3, weren't there, a little bit? I can't quite remember what climb it was van der Poel went clear on, but it was with about 50k to go. And I think at one point, Jorgensen, with echoes of Wout van Aert at E3, I think he got within 6 seconds, touching distance of Van der Poel. And if he was going to do it, and if Van der Poel was going to be brought back, that was the moment. He didn't. Jorgensen didn't get him. And from that point on, the gap got bigger and bigger and bigger. And, I mean, different course, different conditions. Mathieu van der Poel said at the end of the race it was one of the hardest races he's done, largely due to the weather. I think the fact that, I mean, I'm looking at my notes here and I've got 100k to go, wind, capital letters, 89k to go, rain, capital letters, and then 45k to go, Koppenberg, walking. And yeah, that's, you know, to go back to the Koppenberg as well, it wasn't like a van der Poel attack. He was basically one of three or four riders who didn't have to get off. Even looking at some spectator videos doing rounds on social media, you can see I don't know how close he came to losing it, but even van der Poel was losing his back wheel, slipping around. Jorgensen, you know, we know he can climb well, so perhaps at an advantage there. But really, van der Poel was one of, yeah, just a few riders who could physically do that. The rest, even though they were in the front group, had to get off and walk. And as soon as you're doing that, you know, you're just handing van der Poel the advantage. That's game over.
Richard, I said that Van der Poel, well, he romped home, cruised home on his own. His final margin of victory was 1 minute and 2 seconds. His advantage had been, well, significantly more than that, greater than that, for large parts of that sort of solo raid. He'd got up close to 2 minutes at one point. However, behind him, I mentioned Turns and Bettiol were eventually caught, and we had a bunch sprint of sorts and a surprising runner-up in the Italian, Luca Mozzato of Arkea B&B Hotels, who won the bunch sprint for second place. I thought third in that bunch sprint, second in the bunch sprint, third place overall, was Michael Matthews. That's what it looked like on TV. However, Richard, what's happened in the last few minutes?
Well, it seems like Michael Matthews has been relegated for that by the jury.
I have to say, deservedly so, based on what I saw.
I would probably agree with you. He did dive from sort of his left of the road over to the right, somewhat shut the door on Niels Pollitt, who came third in that sprint, has since been bumped up, the beneficiary of Matthews' relegation, to second in that sprint, and therefore third overall. It's kind of ironic because Matthews didn't shut the door on Pogacar in Milan San Remo a few weeks ago, and he narrowly lost out. And then he kind of did shut the door on Pollitt this time around, and got relegated for it. I mean, that's sometimes just how it goes, isn't it? I did see a little clip of him. He looked delighted with a podium, but not to be.
Yeah, and well, what would have been his second podium in two monuments so far this year? And what a waste in the sort of nicest, most generous possible way. What a waste of 6 hours for Michael Matthews. What a waste of a brilliant, brilliant ride for Michael Matthews. Third, as you say, Niels Pollitt. Surprising to see him finish third in a bunch sprint, effectively, or a large group sprint. And UAE had places 3, 4, and 5 in the final results. Pollitt third, Michael Bier fourth, Antonio Morgado on his debut, the Portuguese Neopro fifth, an extremely impressive fifth. Magnus Sheffield sixth for Ineos Grenadiers, Oliver Nasen seventh, Dylan Turns eighth, Alberto Bettiol ninth, and Tom Schuins tenth for Lidl Trek. Richard, we will discuss how Mathieu van der Poel won this Tour of Flanders in more detail in just a minute.
You're listening to Arrivé by The Cycling Podcast. This episode is made possible by Bicycle, the leading global marketplace for pre-owned bikes.
A very big thank you to Bicycle for supporting this series of Arrivé. It's no exaggeration to say that without Bicycle's support, we wouldn't be able to bring you these episodes this spring. So a huge thank you to Bicycle. I've been having a look at the Bicycle.com website. I've also got the app on my phone, and I've been browsing around to see what people are selling, window shopping really, because I'm not actually in the market for a bike at the moment, but I am very interested in what people are selling and the sort of prices that bikes are going for actually. Now, the website itself is really clear and clean and nicely designed, and it works very much like you would expect an online marketplace to work. But the big difference here is that first big search criteria is done for you, because it's exclusively trading in bikes. The website is just bikes, bikes, bikes. And as a result, the filters that enable you to narrow down your search are really cyclist specific. And that automatically gives me a sense of confidence that I'm going to find what I'm looking for. You can search by the sort of criteria that are important to us. Primarily, for me anyway, I would think frame size, the brand, and then you could search even by frame material. You could narrow down the price if you want. You could search by the type of brake, whether you're looking for a disc brake bike or perhaps staying old school with a rim brake bike. You could search by the condition of the bike as well. And just from having a little browse around, it does seem like the sellers on Bicycle are very honest and transparent about their bikes. If you select a fair or good condition bike, you know that you're looking at a bike that has been pre-loved, whereas if you're looking at a very good condition bike or a new or even a brand new bike, you have a degree of confidence, a very good degree of confidence, that the bike is going to be as listed. And even when you're looking at a glance, you can see that someone who really knows about bikes and knows what's important to cyclists has put this together, because the bikes are all listed with the year of manufacture, the size, the type of group set, and then the full model number and name of each bike. So it's really easy to find what you're looking for. And then, well, the sellers do the rest, because everybody's made a real effort to photograph their bike so that it looks in the best light. And that, again, inspires a bit of confidence. But Bicycle will take you through the whole buying and selling process, and they'll be there with you until the end, until both parties are completely happy with the transaction. So if you're in the market for a new bike, well, a pre-loved bike perhaps, go to bicycle.com and see if they have what you're looking for. And judging by the number of brands that are listed for sale on Bicycle, I'm pretty confident that they will have exactly what you are looking for. Now it's back over to Daniel and Richard for the rest of their recap of the Tour of Flanders.
Well, Richard, we were just discussing off mic the roundup of the Ronde, not the tail of the tapper, but the equivalent of the tail of the tapper. It's difficult with Flanders to sum up a race like that, because unlike Milan-San Remo, an awful lot goes on that seems highly, highly important. And, you know, sometimes, Richard, I have to confess, the Tour of Flanders to me is a race that it seems a bit like it's written in Cyrillic, the plot, because there are elements of it that I feel like I really don't understand. And there's always a great, you know, people who know this race much better than me, you know, the commentators, Robin McEwen, for example, or Dan Lloyd, who's ridden the race, they were both commentating on Eurosport today. They're telling you things that are very, very significant, and to the layman, it's quite difficult to appreciate that, especially when, as often is the case today, I think most people would agree that the strongest rider simply won, and won easily. Mm.
Yeah, it's a bit like, it makes me think of a crime novel or like a crime drama on TV when you're sort of half paying attention to it, and then someone comes back in and it's like,
someone's dropping crumbs.
Oh, the postman from 20 minutes in. Oh yeah, that's actually really important. And yeah, and you kind of go back, and the significance of things or individuals or actions, moments only really unveils itself in the final sort of hour or so, when you're like, ah, yeah, that, well, that was important then, because that allowed that to happen.
Could have been important. Yeah. It's a good race for sort of cycling snobs to analyze, isn't it? Because you could quite easily convince someone like me, who is a little bit I'm a little bit, I'm not a Flanders agnostic, but as I said, I feel like I don't speak the language of Flanders, not literally, not Dutch, but I don't speak the language of the Ronde van Vlaanderen. It would be easy for someone who does to convince me that, you know, so and so moving up the inside on a bend after 106 kilometers was vital to the outcome of the race.
Yeah. And that's you hear that all the time, don't you, about the Flemish Ardennes and this sense of like the knowledge, kind of with capital letters, like a London cabbie. You have to know you have the left turn here before the Quarmont, or so on and so on. And then there's this road going to the Kreuzberg, or the, oh no, that's the old Kreuzberg. Actually, what you're thinking about, the new Kreuzberg, you know, and
that's the new Kreuzberg.
And then, yeah, like, I mean, long story short, I was riding up the new Kreuzberg one time as part of this event, and I got dropped there from this bunch, and I was watching it on TV this afternoon with my partner, and said, oh yeah, that was the new Kreuzberg. You know, oh, there's that time where I got dropped. She just looks at me like, what? And unless you're, you know, unless you've been there and done it, some of it can be just kind of irrelevant and sort of mystifying. So I get what you're on about, but then you see how many people are out on the side of the road. It's and how many, a disturbing number of slightly nightmarish Easter Bunny costumes this year as well, with it being Easter Sunday. But it's soaked, it's dripping in Flandrian Flemish culture, isn't it? So, you know.
Well, let's talk about some of the intricacies, and let's try to sound as though we know what we're talking about. Particularly, Richard, I want to focus on Alpecin de Koenig's tactics, the way they rode these ropes, because I do think they did it perfectly. Their strategy seemed to be, well, to my eyes at least, pretty nailed on, and it was really well executed. And I want to focus particularly on this phase of the race between sort of 110 kilometers to go, so before the Molenberg, around about the time where I said Axel Laurence attacked, and the Eau de Quarmont, the first time up the Eau de Quarmont, when Van der Poel, well, he launched his first, I called it a tentative attack, and he effectively bridged up to Mads Pedersen, who had sort of surprised us by, well, opening things up on the Molenberg, attacking on the Molenberg, and then going away shortly thereafter with Jani Vermeers of Alpecin de Koenig. Now, here, what I thought you saw, I think I said in the podcast that we did the other day with Mitch Docker, that Alpecin de Koenig's sort of modus operandi in this phase of these cobbled classics, so from 100 kilometers to go to 50 kilometers to go, was, well, it was generally, these were the sort of last, the last kind of ramparts, the last defenders of Mathieu van der Poel, whether it was Søren Krogh Andersen or whatever, they used their last kind of bullets, and then van der Poel had to really look after himself and do his thing, strut his stuff in the last 50 kilometers. Now, what they did today was they seemed to get ahead of the game. They didn't just want to be cannon fodder for the other teams, which we knew and we'd heard, we'd seen lots of interviews in the days leading up to the race, and even before the start of the race today. There was a lot of talk about the long-range attacks from other teams opening things up early. Now, what Alpecin de Koenig did was sort of get ahead of all of that by, well, sort of giving as good as they got and making sure that they were going with those moves. And, you know, Jani Vermeersch working with Mads Pedersen, I thought it was ingenious in the sense that we talked the other day about Pedersen's propensity to really commit when he had an idea in his head, when he had a move that he wanted to make. He's not a rider who sort of flim-flams around and looks over his shoulder and thinks, is this a good idea? He'd obviously decided, or the team had obviously decided, that was how he was going to move. And by working with him, Vermeersch made sure that he spent, well, what was it, almost, well, it was 40 odd kilometers.
Yeah, I mean, it was 31. It was about 31 where he was either alone or with Vermeersch. I mean, we can kind of discuss, I suppose, the sanity or the reason behind Pedersen doing that maybe later on. I mean, spoiler alert, it didn't work. But there was a crucial moment there on the Valkenburg where running into that climb, like asphalt climb, no cobbles, but Van der Poel had three Alpecin riders on the front, basically leading him out. He used that as a sprint, sprinted up the Valkenburg and bridged across to that kind of dangerous looking group. At that point, Van der Poel's alone, and you're kind of thinking, well, unless, if they're not careful, Alpecin are going to be in a bit of bother here because there's 85 kilometers to go and Van der Poel's blown all his teammates. And that was what Pedersen was perhaps thinking. He went off alone at that point. And had Pedersen got away with anybody else, that could have been a really dangerous move because Van der Poel's alone. But the one rider that went with him was Vermeersch. And at that point, you know, that's exactly how Alpecin wanted it, because they had that move up the road, which was kind of what all the other teams wanted. They want to move gone ahead of Van der Poel, but there was an Alpecin rider with it. So yeah, yeah, like you said, allowing Vermeersch to work and just kind of hang Pedersen out to dry sort of took him out of the race, essentially.
We talked, Richard, the other day about how Van der Poel has improved and how his positioning has improved. That's something that's very obvious and you can see. You know, I also talked the other day about how I feel that he's got this confidence whereby he's not afraid to lose races and he takes the necessary risks, the sort of advantages, the risks that kind of pay off. He doesn't get jumpy and he doesn't panic. And I think today as well showed how much more maybe he trusts his team. I mean, his team has got stronger. I think his team has got better than it was a year or two ago. But I feel that you can only race the way he did today if you have quite a lot of confidence in your team, particularly in that phase of the race, and which proves to be kind of key between sort of 110k to go and 50k to go.
Yeah, I think so. I was thinking about this earlier in comparison with Wout van Aert, but you know, I think back in maybe 5 years ago when Van der Poel chose to stay with what was Corendon Circus, you know, and really instead of, I don't know how many offers he had from, inverted commas, bigger teams to go on a bigger contract to a more established team, but he chose to stay there and have that team and help that team grow with him. And certainly in comparison to Wout van Aert, who is on Visma Lisebike, a team with multiple objectives. Some of them have nothing to do with Wout van Aert other than they want to employ him to help. Van der Poel's got that team kind of at his beck and call, really, and especially in a race like Flanders. And I guess what we're seeing is the culmination of that investment, right? He's been with the Roodhoff brothers and that team, you know, the Roodhoff brothers being the two managers. He's been with them his whole career. So he's been able to craft that team around exactly what he needs, I think. And it was Axel Laurence, wasn't it? He was in that first move. He was a late starter, wasn't he? He had a good ride at Catalunya. Did he won his first World Tour stage run?
Yeah, and he won a race in France earlier this year as well. And of course, he's the under 23 world champion.
Exactly. So yeah, like I guess just that flexibility to put that rider in, and I suppose the depth as well that perhaps they maybe hadn't had in the past. But I think as well we've seen a mature Van der Poel, aren't we? We're seeing a rider who's no longer that sort of slightly unhinged wrecking ball that sometimes that would work. Quite often you couldn't deal with it when it did, but quite often the energy was misplaced or was just a little bit, he'd sort of blow himself up in the process. I remember, was it Yorkshire 2019 where he took himself out of the world by cramping? And you know, this the sort of, yeah, that was it. And Pedersen won that race, as it turns out. But I think we're seeing a sort of more mature, more sort of slow burn Van der Poel, aren't we now?
Today did feel less kind of wrecking ball, less heavy metal than a usual Van der Poel victory, but was that simply because it was so predictable and widely predicted? It felt more of a sort of velvet dagger kind of performance. Everything seemed pretty measured and it didn't really need any huge exclamation marks. Or was that the sort of prism of or the kind of inevitability goggles that we were watching the race through? I mean, this morning in L'Equipe, you know, they always have a star rating, give riders star ratings before the big classics and grand tours, and Van der Poel had 5 stars this morning and there was no one on 4 stars, and I don't think there was anyone on 3 stars either. That's how much of an emphatic favorite he was.
Yeah, I mean, in one sense you could say that the most the most important sort of tactical point of the race came with 67 kilometers to go of Dwaze Dor Vlaanderen last Wednesday, because I think we'd be having a very different conversation if Wout van Aert was there, if Pedersen hadn't had to shed 4 kilos of inflamed fluid retention, if Stuyven was there. You know, that Wout van Aert is perhaps, well, we saw Visma Lisebike could put a rider up there on the Koppenberg because they did. It was Matteo Jorgensen. Were that Wout van Aert, would a gap open up? I don't know. I mean, that's, we can't say, but I do think the fact that the race was missing van Aert meant that Van der Poel didn't need to kind of hit the nuclear option, because I don't think there was a rider of the caliber to take him on in those conditions, on the wet, in the cobbles, in that race. He's now, let me just count that up, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, he's the 7th rider to win it 3 times in a row, and actually the first in history with 5 consecutive podiums. So it's 4th, 1st, 2nd, 1st, 2nd, and now 1st again. So, you know, that sort of, the stats there show, I guess, how he is the sort of, it's a bit like if you asked AI to create a rider that can do well in the Tour of Flanders, you'd come up with Van der Poel, wouldn't you?
Yeah, a few other stats. Of course, he joins the 3-time winners. I won't list them all. Eric LeMond, Eddy Merckx, Fabian Cancellara, Tom Boonen are among them. Fiorenzo Magni, and I will actually.
Is Merckx in there? I haven't got Merckx on my list.
Yeah, Merckx is all there. Johan Museu and Akhil Bosa. And was the first rider in history with 5 consecutive podiums in the Tour of Flanders. Solo wins in Flanders, Richard. Couple of notable ones. There have been more and more spectacular than these, but a couple that came to my mind. Philippe Gilbert in 2017, 55.5 kilometres off the front. Van der Poel was 40-something today, wasn't it? And Eddy Merckx in 1969, 73 kilometres off the front. Winners in the rainbow jersey, a few of those in sort of recent decades. Eddy Merckx in 1975, Tom Boonen in 2006, Peter Sagan in 2016. Richard, just on, well, rainbow jerseys, former rainbow jerseys, Mads Pedersen, you mentioned that he won the World Championships in Yorkshire in 2019. And what do we think then about his, well, this preemptive move, if that's the right word for it, certainly opening things up very early. I think a lot of people, most people, my interpretation of that was that it was a sign that he didn't feel at his best. He probably, had he not crashed in Dwaze Dor Vlaanderen, he probably would have had a slightly different strategy today.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to be a fly on the wall on the Lidl Trek team bus, wouldn't it, at the moment, after that, the post-mortem. I mean, listening to what Tom Skoinch had to say, to sort of paraphrase, we wanted to start the racing early, but maybe we got a bit too excited. And I think, yeah, it felt, we know that Mads Pedersen likes sort of to go from a long way out, and if he was going to beat Van der Poel, that was how he was going to do it. We saw that in Geint Wevelgem. But it did sort of smack of a little bit of tactical, I don't know, not naivety, I think, but maybe just, is it possible for the moment to, well, yeah, it is. The Tour of Flanders, of course it's possible for the moment to kind of get ahead of you a little bit, perhaps. Or I think that the move would have been ideal for Lidl Trek, assuming that Pedersen was their strongest rider. It would have been ideal had someone like Skoinch or even Jonathan Milan been that rider doing it. Had a similar tactical effect, but Pedersen could have kept his powder dry. As it was, yeah, he was just out there far too long on his own, that, you know, when it came to crunch time, he was within touching distance, wasn't he, on the Koppenberg with 40-odd K to go. But from that point, he was just dropping further and further back through the field. So obviously paying for those efforts.
Well, Richard, shall we, in fact, since we've got it hot, sizzling off the press, hear from a man who definitely does know why Mads Pedersen rode the way he did today. Guess who that is? Mads Pedersen. Here he is.
I had better races and better days, but yeah, I did what I could, and I think I got the best out of today, considering the crash with Fleck.
Was it planned to attack so far from finishing?
No, but I didn't have this extra power on the climbs. I suffered a lot on the climbs, and I did have this high power today, so I hope that the gap would have been a bit bigger, so they, you know, so I could go a bit slow on the climb and keep it within the power range I felt more comfortable in. But yeah, the plan didn't work out well, so sometimes it pays off and sometimes it doesn't. And if you look at it now, I should maybe have done it different, but anyway, it wouldn't have been a top result today.
And how do you feel now after your injuries? What brings the tension?
Yeah, hopefully a good race on Sunday in a week. You know, now I have 7 days to recover and prepare, and we believe I will be 100% in 7 days.
Well, there you have it, Richard, from the horse's mouth, Mads Pettersson. And among the vanquished, so Mads Pettersson was one of the outsiders, one of the most likely, the most palpable winners, I suppose. If it wasn't going to be Mathieu van der Poel, that's certainly how it was spun in the media before the race. Another of the sort of strong candidates was Matteo Jorgensen after his win in Oise en Flandres on Wednesday, particularly, well, also after his win in Paris-Nice a couple of weeks ago. Richard, this just looked like one race too far or too much for Matteo Jorgensen, in the sense that he was, well, by far, and Visma Lisa Bike's leading candidate, and the way he rode today suggested to me that he would have been a huge asset had they gone in with their normal team. But the sort of single-pronged approach with Jorgensen as the kind of deputy Wout van Aert was just a little bit too much to ask.
Yeah, and I think you can point to maybe some a little bit of naivety on Jorgensen's part in terms of how active he was early when things kicked off, sort of 100 or 90 kilometres to go.
How many people have we called naive?
I don't know. Everyone except Mathieu van der Poel. I guess, suppose that's, you can flip that the other way around and say that when you are racing against somebody who can do what van der Poel can do, it does make you look tactically naive, because it's always kind of shown in the light of, well, this guy's just won solo by 2 minutes. So, but also I think, well, we talked about Visma missing some of their key riders, but this is kind of quite a strong metaphor when Thijs Benoot needed a bike change just in that final run into the finish, and they gave him Dylan van Baarle's spare bike, which I think had the wrong pedal system on it. So, you know, sort of rode a little bit and then swapped again, and yeah, sort of a day to forget for them. I don't know about Jorgensen. He was very impressive in Oise en Flandres, wasn't he? But is he going to win? Has he got the kind of the grunt or the capacity to win one of these Cobble Classics? I'm not sure.
Oh, I think this early in his, I mean, there's already been a transformation. He's 24 years of age. There's already been a transformation since he's joined Visma Lisabik at the start of the year. I think the sky is the limit for Matteo Jorgensen, or certainly that we don't know what his limitations are, if indeed he does have any limitations. Well, one is that he's not a fast rider, he's not a fast finisher, so that will always be a bit of a handicap for him. But I would be very excited if I was him and Visma Lisabike about what he can achieve in the future.
Yeah, he finished 31st in the end, so well down, got caught by that, a couple of chasing groups.
Yeah, he faded quite badly, didn't he, with sort of 20, 25 kilometres to go. Other notable performances, well, we already mentioned Antonio Morgado of UAE Team Emirates. Fifth place, I don't have the statistic available at the moment, but I would suggest it's possibly been quite a long time since a 20-year-old, and he's only really just turned 20, 28th of January, finished in the top five in the Tour of Flanders. Has a Portuguese rider ever finished in the top five of the Tour of Flanders? I would suggest possibly not, bearing in mind who the great sort of Portuguese riders of the last 20, 30, 40 years have been. They've not been known for their prowess in the Cobble Classics. Richard, talking of excitement, it could be an exciting evening. It could be an exciting rest of the afternoon. It's going to be an exciting week, certainly in professional cycling anyway. We've got Paris-Roubaix Next weekend. Before that, we've got our usual episode. I think we'll be recording on Tuesday, where we will talk in much more detail, well, about some of the storylines that have been thrown up by the Tour of Flanders and some of the things we've missed. No doubt we've missed a lot of things. No doubt we'll also, I don't know, maybe we'll pick a few other riders to call naive as well on Tuesday. and until then, Richard, I'm going to say, I hope you enjoy your evening. I'm going to hope I enjoy mine, for reasons that are probably obvious now. And until then, goodbye.
Goodbye.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Burney.